Hello and welcome back to the Plutarch Podcast. I'm your host, Tom Cox from Grammaticus.co. And we're here today to talk about Publius, Publicola, Valerius Publius, whatever you want to call him. He's most famous for Americans for becoming the pen name of not one, but three American citizens as they tried to encourage their fellow New Yorkers and ultimately the entirety of the 13 colonies to ratify the Constitution of the United States. He's also the second Roman statesman we've talked about, and he'll be our fourth Roman life. So we've talked about the high watermark of Roman statesmanship. A man like Cicero would look back to a man like Publius and think, how can I be like him? But we've also talked about the era of the kings. Plutarch covers all seven kings in two lives. The other five kings get about a paragraph at the end of the life of Numa, as we talked about in the last episode. And so now we're on to the founding of the Republic. And he does not dedicate a life to its true founder, Brutus. Instead, he dedicates a life to its not second, but third consul. He's really still a consul in the first year, but we'll explain how that happens as we get into the story. So who is this man, and what am I going to call him? Plutarch calls him Valerius for about half the life, which is spelled really funny in Greek. And then he starts calling him Publicola, or Publicola, again, don't really care how you pronounce it, once the Roman people have decided to give him that nickname. And again, we'll get there later in the life when we get there. But I'm going to call him Publius throughout, because it's the name that's most famous to English speakers through the Federalist Papers, and it's also a lot easier to say than Publicola, or Publicola, and a little bit easier to say than Valerius. Also, there's another character who starts with a V, who kind of important in the first third of the life, and it would be really confusing to go back and forth between Valerius and Vindicius, or Valerius and Windicius, if we're in the classical pronunciation. So let's just jump right in, shall we? Publius's parallel is Solon, and we've already covered Solon, the famous Athenian lawgiver, who didn't quite start democracy in Athens, but certainly got the ball rolling in that direction with his reforms that favored some of the lower classes and some of those not in power, particularly those struggling with debt and debt slavery. But Publius, as we'll call him, was already from an important and prominent family, much like Solon. And his family already had a reputation for integrity, boldness, injustice, a willingness to serve the people. That actually might be where their last name, their patronym, comes from, because Publius means of the people, people-like, people-focused. And in his lifetime, Marcus Junius Brutus expels the final Roman king, Tarquinius Superbus, or as my students like to say when they're first reading it out loud, Superbus. That's not his name. Superbus, which means proud. So he ruled with hubris, he ruled with pride. The life begins with a summary of how this Tarquinius Superbus got exiled. And it's a long story, but essentially, Tarquinius Superbus and his family began to overstep their bounds in the way they treated other noble Romans. They overstepped their bounds so much so that a woman ends up dead, and a family ends up ashamed of themselves or ashamed of what they've been put through, and Tarquin is run out of town. We'll call him Tarquin from now on, but his full name was Tarquinius Superbus. So the Senate, immediately after ejecting or rejecting Tarquin, does this thing where one of them rules for a few months and then the next one takes over and the next one takes over. And the problem that the regular people have with that is that they think they're just going to get an oligarchy in place of a monarchy. And that's not what they want. So they set up a system where Brutus is elected as a consul, but the Romans no longer want just one ruler. And since we just finished the life of Lycurgus as well, we'll see a parallel in the Roman consulship in the Spartan kingship. There's a balance that comes with having two executives, as well as a flexibility that allows the leaders of the army and those in control of matters of state to be where they need to be, and almost for Rome itself to be in two places at once if necessary. So Brutus is elected that first consul, but Valerius is sadly not elected it as co-consul. It's actually Collatinus, a man who's related to that family who was so ashamed that they ran Tarquin out of town. But the problem with exiling a monarch is that you just send him straight to your enemies, because the enemy of your enemy is your friend. And so when Valerius is not elected consul, he withdraws from the Senate and he withdraws from public life. And at first, people are really disappointed. But then Brutus realizes that that Tarquin has not actually run very far away and will probably be coming back with an army. But if he doesn't have to fight, he won't fight, which means Tarquin will use his connections inside of the city to try to restore the monarchy. And Brutus is really worried about this. So he actually requires an oath. He wants all of the Romans to line up and swear an oath never to return to a monarchy, never to accept a king. And the first person in line is the guy that has given up all public life, Publius. So meanwhile, Tarquin is still trying to win people over in spite of this oath and all the other things that Brutus has tried. And then things get worse. Tarquin sees that his primary enemy is Brutus. And so he tries to take Brutus out. And he actually corrupts a number of Romans, including Brutus's own two sons. And Tarquin has all kinds of ways of infiltrating, right? One way is he wants to negotiate for his property and money back. And so the envoys that he sends are sort of delaying in the city because, you know, he had a lot of property and he had a lot of stuff. So we've got to make sure it's all accounted for. But in reality, they're setting up this plot, this coup against Brutus. And one of the reasons Plutarch guesses the sons of Brutus may be involved in this is because of how hard Brutus was as a man. They perhaps want to replace the tyranny of their father with the tyranny of their king. Perhaps that's how Brutus earned such a disreputable name. Brutus does mean stupid or brutish or animal-like. Something to keep in mind with the decisions we'll see him make later. But a slave named Vindicius discovers this plot. This plot is very, very dark. They seem to swear an oath on the blood and entrails of a dead man. And Vindicius overhears or eavesdrops and runs away. And the first man he decides to tell is Publius, because Publius is trustworthy and kept his house open to all those who needed help. So Publius, of course, brings this plot to public attention, and Brutus brings justice to the conspirators. Public justice to the conspirators, and to his own sons, he brings immediate justice. This is a really hard story, even for Plutarch to tell. But essentially, Brutus, as consul, uses the lictors, which are those guys that carry the rods and the axes of the fasces. They are the signs of Roman authority. But they're also the signs of the ability for the executive. Those rods are their ability to chastise you if you don't follow the law, to beat you. And in the middle of those rods are the axes, one axe head or a double axe head. And that double axe head represents the power or the authority for capital punishment. Well, it's not just a representation in this story, because Brutus demands that the lictors, right there, once enough evidence has been gathered against his sons, and it has become clear that they were part of this conspiracy, he orders the lictors right there to beat them to the ground, that's the rods, and to behead them with the axes. And even Plutarch considers this either superhumanly virtuous or completely and totally animal-like. But there's really no in-between. He's just really not sure if he should praise this to the skies as a fantastic or impressive display of virtuous self-control, or condemn it as one of the most unnatural sins known to man. There's that brutal and brutish pun on his name. So Collatinus, the other consul serving with Brutus, was also part of this plot. And he is not immediately brought to justice. Brutus only immediately executed his sons. So we have to find a way to take care of these other conspirators. And this is a really early conspiracy. This is the first year that the Republic is in existence, right? The Republic is a tiny baby, and already there's strife and civil discord in the heart of Rome. But here, Brutus is called back to the forum and asks, what do we do with the other conspirators? It's actually Publius that calls him back, because Brutus just left after his sons had been killed. And he says, oh, we can leave that up to a popular vote. And the people of Rome vote unanimously to condemn and behead all the other conspirators. Collatinus manages to withdraw from politics and leave the city. And so here, Publius gets his first public rise to prominence. He is elected as what's called a consul suffect, which is a consul to finish out that year. So when a consul dies in the middle of a year, which is usually for the Romans at this time from March to March, they'll elect another consul to finish up the term. And Publius is that consul. He takes Vindicius, remember that slave, who was the informer of this whole plot. And he gives him not just his freedom, but also citizenship with a vote in any of the curias of his choosing. And so all the way down to Plutarch's own day, this kind of manumission, this kind of freeing of a slave, where the slave doesn't just get his freedom, doesn't just become a libertus, a freedman, but goes all the way to being a civis, a citizen, is called a vindicta. And obviously we get words like vindicate from this story and this idea. So now we need to purge the remains of anything related to Tarquin in the city. Now that we have decided we're going to do this republic thing. And so they raise the palace of the Tarquins to the ground. And it just so happens that this is now the field of Mars. So this will become the place where all the Romans gather for military drills or anything that requires large amounts of space, sometimes certain festivals. They empty the fields of trees and they're dumping all of this stuff into the river, all of the trash and rubble. And it actually turns out that it gets stuck in the Tiber River. Rome is located in a bend in the river, and you'll look at that bend and you'll see that that bend, which is all built up now with Renaissance era buildings, was the Field of Mars. If you've ever been to Piazza Navona in Rome, Piazza Navona is pretty close to the Field of Mars. So they throw all the rubble into the Tiber, and it floats down and gets caught on something and eventually creates that Tiber Island that's just across the river from Trastevere, for those of you who know Rome. But yeah, he gives an alternative story in there, but I like that one. Then, of course, they have all of their nearby neighbors. Remember, Rome is still the size of a Greek polis at this point. They're really no different from a Greek polis in the sense that they own their city and the area around them. But if you go upriver or downriver, they don't even necessarily control all of that. One of the Roman kings had given them access to the port at Ostia. But really, other than that, they are still surrounded by enemies. And didn't even have access to the sea when they were originally founded. So it seems that one of the reasons we may not be doing the life of Brutus is because in the very next battle against the Tuscans, who roll down to form an alliance and attack on behalf of Tarquin, the monarch, to bring him back and put him back in power, there's a son of Tarquin named Aruns who meets Brutus in battle, and basically they duel, fight to the death, and both men die. And the battle kind of ends in this similarly indecisive way, where it's a draw, and you lost most of your most important people, and so Publius is perplexed, and you get a lot of Deus Ex Machina explanations that evening. Nobody really knows who won, but at night, they hear a booming voice declaring that the Romans lost one fewer man than the Tuscans. All right, I guess that solves it. The Romans win. And the next day, they actually count the dead, and the god was right. And so on the last day of February, Publius celebrates a triumph. So remember that Romulus had celebrated a triumph, and he had a famous 1v1-2 in which he marches through the city of Rome with the armor of the man he had killed, But this is interesting that the Roman people allow Publius to have the first triumph because it seems like it might have been something that would have been reserved for kings. But there's a continuity here, even though the Republic is a new form of government. It's not like the Romans are throwing out all of the traditions that they had before. And the triumph is a nice continuation of that tradition. So Publius delivers a funeral oration in Brutus's honor, and he also starts the custom of funeral orations, which had begun even earlier for the Romans than for the Greeks. So this is another way, if we're dropping Publius into history around 508 BC, when the Roman Republic is founded, he's after Solon, but before Themistocles. So he's really right as Cleisthenes is alive, and Cleisthenes is not a life that Plutarch does, but he's the father of Athenian democracy, so Athens is switching to a democracy. Sparta has been a military oligarchy for a long time. Lycurgus, if he existed, existed, you know, a century or more before Publius did. And so he's right there between Solon, the lawgiver of Athens, and Cleisthenes, the one who threw out the tyrant's sons, Hippias and Hipparchus, and founded the democracy. So we're having two popular governments start around the same time. The standard date for the founding of the Roman Republic is 509 BC, and the standard date for the Athenian democracy is 508 BC.
So with Brutus dead, Publius is now ruling alone. And this starts to bother the people because it feels like deja vu. We've been here with the kings. We were here even in the interregnum when one consul would rule for a little while, and then were they ever going to hand the power over? So Publius becomes unpopular, and people start to notice other things about Publius that bothers them. And the first is his obnoxiously large house at the top of the Palatine Hill, overlooking the Forum. It's up high. He's better than everybody else. It looks down on us. We don't like it. But Publius does not respond like a Tarquin would, or like a tyrant would. Instead, he's somebody that listens to what the people say. So much so that it's almost as if, with his actions, he says, fine, you don't like that I have a nice house. It's not fitting for somebody who's not a king to act this way. I hear you. I hear you so well that in the span of one day, I'm going to bring in as many workmen as I need overnight to tear down my house in a single day, brick by brick, so that the next morning you will wake up and that house that you thought was such an eyesore, gone. It's not there anymore. And now I have to live with my family, other members of my family. So how do you feel about that? And the Romans, so he says this all with his actions, by the way, not in the obnoxious way that I just put it into words, but as we know, actions speak louder than words. Sometimes they speak in my voice. And the Romans are actually really bothered by this and shocked and surprised. It would be like any millionaire we could name today or billionaire we could name today burning his house down publicly to show everybody that he doesn't care about the money. It's highly unlikely, and it would be just as shocking. So he does eventually build a smaller house at the bottom of the hill, both representing his humility, returning closer to the earth, but also his connection to the people. And this is what earns him their respect, and it earns him not only respect, but also a name change. His name is changed from Publius, or Gaius Valerius Publius, but who's counting, to Publicola. And Publicola means cultivator of the people. The word cola comes from the Latin verb colo colere, and gives us the image of a farmer looking after his field or a shepherd taking care of his flock. That's how in touch Publius is with the will of the people and the needs of the people. And he didn't just cave to them because he's a populist. I don't think, because we're going to see other populists that Plutarch will critique, and Themistocles is one of them. He doesn't see this as just a power move. He sees this as something that the people were right about and that he needed to respond to. So it's a little different when we get to the life of Themistocles. We'll see that Themistocles sort of cunningly decides where he's going to live in Athens. And he purposely lives close to his voting block, where they live near the Agora, so that he can pass them on a daily basis, talk to them on a daily basis. And there's both, obviously, the practical benefit of knowing his base as well, and talking to them every day, and being able to speak directly to their problems. But the way that Plutarch paints it with Themistocles is a little bit more cunning than Publius's just sort of regular response of, all right, the people are bothered and they're right to be bothered by that. I don't need that big a house. I'm tearing it down almost instantly. That's really cool. And Plutarch points out that this increases his authority with the Roman people. And it's funny that he gets a nickname, not for a lot of the other reasons that Romans will often get nicknames. The most common reason that you will get a nickname in Rome is because of who you conquer. So Germanicus gets the nickname because he conquered the Germans, or theoretically crossed over into the German border and won some battles. We get Macedonicus. It becomes the nickname of the guy who conquers Macedon. And it's interesting that this nickname is not the conquest of foreigners, but it's almost the conquest of the hearts of his own people, the hearts and minds of his own people. It's really cool. And he's not actually done. So notice that they started by being annoyed that he was sole consul. Then they sort of got distracted by the house being a symbol of him acting more like a king than a consul. And then he fixed the house problem, and it sort of bought him time to act as sole consul for a while. And we'll see the reforms he runs through as sole consul before allowing another election to go through.
So Publius is now the sole consul, and he's got to figure out what reforms to run through before he sets up these next consular elections for a consul suffect. He allows anybody to run for consul, but he stacks the deck in his favor by choosing more senators. We've seen other kings choose senators, especially when men fell in battle, right? The senators at this time are obviously still high-level generals, and they're all fighting. So he brings the Senate numbers back up to 164, and then he makes a few other cool reforms, right? He gives the defendant a right to appeal to the people. This is almost like the opposite of what Solon had done. Solon had reserved murder cases for the court of the Areopagus. But here, sounds like even in murder, the defendant could be tried before a judge, but then could also make the people his jury. And this becomes a very common tactic in later Roman politics to say, all right, I don't like this decision, so I'm going to let the people decide. And then to go before the people and basically have the decision reversed. He puts in some tax relief and lowers some fines on things, particularly the fine for disobedience to a consul, which I think is interesting. We also get a cool etymology for money, where pecunia is the Latin word for money, and it comes from pecus, which is the Latin word for any herd animal. And so Plutarch talks about how Roman coins often have pictures or images, I should say, of cows, pigs, and goats, and also how those are common Roman names. But it is also, he additionally would like to point out that these herd animals are a sign of wealth, or are actual wealth. Owning herd animals means you are wealthy. And that's the original etymology of pecunia, money. But Plutarch actually likes him because he's severe on severe crimes and moderate on moderate ones. So disobedience to a consul, he considers a moderate crime. Whereas anyone seeking tyranny is allowed to be killed without a trial. Compare that to the life of Cicero as we heard it. Remember, Cicero essentially puts Catiline on trial for trying to overthrow the state. He puts Catiline on trial before the Senate because Catiline is a senator. And there's some limitations in how he has to uncover this plot and make the Senate meet. And so Cicero has to be very careful. But what Cicero does not do is do the standard procedures for a trial, because he knows Catiline would be able to buy his way out. So he does a slightly altered form and has the Senate declare, through what's called a senatus consultum ultimum, that Catiline ought to die. And Catiline ends up dying in battle anyway, but his conspirators are put to death in the Mamertine prison. And you can see that there's a precedent here for this in Publius, which is cool. He sets up the Temple of Saturn as a treasury. I just did a big article on the blog about maps that would work really well for Plutarch, and I'll drop a map of Republican Rome in the show notes for this so that you can see where the Temple of Saturn was located. But it's common to put the large amounts of money in the hands of priests and a temple. The Egyptians did it, the Greeks did it, now the Romans are doing it, because it was a way that you could keep things safe. This is the same treasury that in the life of Julius Caesar is going to break into by force, and the one quaestor that stands in the way to stop him, or maybe it's a senator, basically he says, it is harder for me to tell you that I'm going to have to kill you than it will be for me to do it. And that makes the quaestor back down. So, speaking of quaestors, he sets up the first two treasurers. So the first two quaestors are named by Publius, and he sets the tax rates for everybody who will be paying into the treasury and makes widows and orphans exempt. And then finally, there is a suffect consul appointed, and then he dies a few days later, so another one is. So then we get this really cool, let's call it an excursus, because what we're going to get is the rest of the life feels sort of strange in the sense that Publius seems to fall into the background after about halfway through the life. There's a few things that he does that are really important still, but it's always a way that Plutarch uses it to sort of pivot and look at the Roman people as a whole. And I think this is really cool. I don't think Plutarch did this on accident, although he didn't have probably as much source material for somebody like Publius as he did about, you know, later Romans like Cicero or even some of the legendary kings. He probably could have had more material for just because they had reached mythic proportions at that point. But I think that he's also making a deeper point about the difference between a monarchy and a republic. In the monarchy, whether you're Numa or Romulus, right, whether you're a holy king bent on teaching the people piety, or whether you're a warlike man who often oversteps his bounds and squashes people in the process, you're still a monarch. There's still some way in which it's all on you, and the people matter less than you do. But Publius now runs a republic, and so the people matter more. And so in these stories, even though the life is technically Publius's, we get to see the effect that a republic had on its fellow citizens. This will be a huge virtue that other eras and times will come to respect immensely, particularly the Renaissance and like Machiavelli,
right?
But this idea is one that starts to contrast being a citizen versus a subject, which is a great theme that runs through all of Plutarch. So one of the first excursies is this temple to Jupiter. The fifth king of Rome, so the third to last king of Rome, had promised Jupiter a temple on the Capitoline, on the main and most important hill of Rome. It isn't until his grandson takes the throne, Tarquinius Superbus, that it starts to be built. But it had not reached the point of consecration by the time Tarquinius Superbus is driven out of Rome. So Publius now gets that job. It would be kind of nice to have somebody mostly finish a temple for you, and you just have to put the chariot on top. Oh, because that's what he does. Bad pun alert. But it's also an image, I think, of the justice in government, of the way the Republic sort of crowns what Romulus had founded. What the kings had started, Publius is finishing. And Jupiter, so to speak, is blessing. So some wanted to give the other consul, Horatius, the privilege of consecrating the temple. And so they do a sneaky backdoor maneuver, which is common in humanity. And they wait for Publius to go on military duty, and they pass the measure, and Horatius is able to do the consecration. But what's interesting is we don't just get that story, right? That was the first story of this temple to Jupiter that's on the Capitoline. But this temple still exists all the way up to Plutarch's day. And he goes into great detail in the next section, telling us that first Sulla, about whom Plutarch has a life, started to rebuild this temple that had fallen into decay. And then another consul actually finishes it for him. So there's another tyrant-like person starting it, with a consul known for his dedication to republican values finishing it. Then we get an emperor, Vespasian, who builds the third round right after the year of three emperors. So shortly after Nero and all the chaos that comes from his death, we get Vespasian, who's able to build and finish the temple. The problem with the third go-round is that when Vespasian dies, the entire capital is lit on fire. And of course, the Temple of Jupiter goes with it. Bad luck, Vespasian. And the fourth temple is completed and consecrated by Domitian. And the gilding of the temple on the current temple significantly overshadows the original cost of the entire construction of the first temple. And so in one image, we get to see not just the monarchy, not just the republic, but even several views of the chaos and the stability that Rome is able to always experience and overcome, experience and come back from. And then Domitian's decadent decision is one that Plutarch thinks is so illustrative of everything that's wrong with Romans right now. Part of the reason he's writing this life of Publius, and that he didn't write a life of Domitian, at least in his parallel lives, is that the Romans have come to be masters of the entire Mediterranean world, but it hasn't necessarily made them better people. So if the pillars are of Pentelic marble, which comes all the way from Attica, Plutarch critiques how the Romans sort of finished them. He said the pillars were perfect, and then because Greeks had made them with perfect proportions, but when they got polished in Rome, they got thinned out and they lost their elegance and harmony, and they just looked weird, right? Like too thin, like toothpicks. But he also critiques Domitian for having the excesses of Midas and wanting everything he touches to turn to gold or marble. I think that's a great story. Then we zoom in on this character, Lars Porsena. You may have heard of him because there's the Thomas Babington Macaulay poem about Horatius at the bridge. Yes, that's coming. Yes, you should read that. Yes, I'll link to it in the show notes. But Tarquin flees to another enemy of Rome called at Clusium. And he's considered, Lars Porsena is considered at the time the most powerful king in Italy. Porsena tries to order the Romans to take Tarquin back as their king. They refuse, and so now they are at war with Lars Porsena. Publius at this point is re-elected consul, and he's trying to build up the city and garrison it in the teeth of an oncoming attack. In so doing, he's, you know, occasionally sallying forth to give them some breathing room. He's wounded in the attack, and so is the other consul, and so the Romans themselves start to fall back. So this is where we see Publius kind of fades out of the picture, in part because he's wounded. Obviously, this is like book 13 of the Iliad, where you need to make space for Achilles to eventually, or first Patroclus, and then Achilles to come on the battlefield. So what do? You wound all your heroes, all your important heroes. Agamemnon gets double wounded, Odysseus gets wounded, Diomedes get wounded, right? That is a nice literary technique for allowing some space for the people who are really going to shine. But what's cool here is it's not like Publius doesn't shine as the Republic shines. He's the man who defended the consulship. He defended Brutus. He defended the rights of the people against a returning tyrant. And so who steps into the breach? We have the famous Horatius Cocles, who's already a wounded veteran. So this man has already, young man, has already fought in war, and he decides to hold the bridge alone, because it's a nice little narrow strait, and he holds the bridge against Lars Porsena's men, while two of his friends completely take the bridge apart, so that as the Romans can run back across the Tiber, all the Romans have made it, he holds them off as his friends destroy the bridge, and then he jumps into the river and swims across, while taking several wounds. It's not clear how many, but in gratitude for this, the Roman people grant him as much land as he can plow in a day, an allowance of food for life, which is what Olympic victors got in the Greek world, and he gets a statue in the temple of Vulcan, a statue of himself, but in the temple of Vulcan, who's Hephaestus. Which is funny because in the stories, he's stabbed in the back of the upper thigh. Let's figure out what part that is. So he limps probably for the rest of his life from that wound. And the statue of him is there to console him for the limp while at the same time celebrating his godlike actions. You pick the limping god and put his statue there. But Lars Porsena is not defeated. He's just slowed down. So he then sets up a siege and is besieging Rome. And then we get another famous story from the early Republic. Again, Publius isn't involved at all, but a man named Mucius, yes, that's hard to say, sneaks into the camp and runs up after observing this, the main dais where all the leaders are gathered for a little while. He runs up and stabs in the chest the man who he thinks is Lars Porsena. Well, he got it wrong. He actually stabbed Lars Porsena's secretary. Okay, that's rough. Because of that, he gets captured. And so while they're holding him in front of Lars Porsena, Mucius famously puts his right hand over a charcoal fire that Lars Porsena had had there because he was about to perform a sacrifice, and watches his hand burn away without flinching. He then says, "There are 300 Romans just like me, who would be willing to do this, and we will all be chosen by lot, and eventually we will get you, and you will die." The number 300 is kind of cool, because it's the number of Spartans that died at Thermopylae. And it's also something that impresses Lars Porsena. Let's be real, this is in the category of Brutus killing his own sons. How many people could consciously, or at all, stick their hand in a fire and watch it burn away while not flinching? It's really weird. At that point, Lars Porsena is so impressed by the Romans that he sues for peace out of respect for the nobility of the Romans, which is great. And Publius submits Tarquin's case to Lars Porsena for dispute. This might sound weird, right? Like some sort of international politics, like have a third arbiter come in. But I think Publius knows what he's doing. He knows Lars Porsena better than we do, because it impresses Lars Porsena so much when he watches that Publius is willing to have Porsena judge them, because he now understands his character, and Tarquin still refuses, even though Tarquin also knows Porsena. And because of Tarquin's refusal, it converts Lars Porsena from an adversary to an ally. And that same tactic that Tarquin was trying to do, which is take Rome without spilling a drop of blood, but by using money, he was unable to do because Publius had used virtue. Publius had sought justice and was able to flip an adversary to an ally, which is really cool. Then the Romans exchange hostages. Publius fades back into the background, and we get another couple stories that are interesting. Part of the prisoner women go down to the river to bathe. They're not sent a guard, and the women essentially swim away down the river. One of them somehow gets a horse. That's not totally explained. But they come back, and Publius is horrified. He's like, look, you were part of the contract, right? We exchanged hostages. We can't have half our hostages coming back. So he actually sends the girls, which include his own daughter, Valeria, back to Lars Porsena. And then there's a further wrinkle in this problem. Tarquin sets an ambush to kill these Roman women on their way back. Valeria escapes, and the son of Lars Porsena, confusingly named the same as the son of Tarquin, Aruns, saves them all. And so there's a statue commemorating the bravery of the women. So obviously not all of the Romans. So it was clearly a brave decision, even if Publius thought it was an unwise one. And so the statue that commemorates their bravery is on the Via Sacra. People disagree about whether it's Cloelia or Valeria, but it is a woman mounted on a horse. So Porsena evacuates his camp at this point because he's now an ally of the Romans. And to show his goodwill as he leaves all his stuff in the camp. And so essentially the Romans get to sack a camp without having to kill the people in it. And because they're so wowed by his generosity, they put up a bronze statue near the Senate House in his honor. So talk about going from adversary to ally to best friend. So then Publius's brother becomes consul. So it's all in the family, right? We see this is common not only in politics back then, but in politics today. It's often who you're related to that gets you the chance or the spotlight enough to get elected to an office. His brother is a successful general. He manages to win a battle against the Sabines without losing a single Roman soldier, and according to Plutarch, killing 13,000 of the enemy. I'm just here to report what Plutarch said. You can make your own decisions about that. So for this, Publius's brother Marcus gets a triumph, and the doors of his house are set in a way that is different from the doors of most people's, where they go directly out into the street as a sign of public honor. So Publius then starts on his last consulship, and he's elected consul for the fourth time, and the Sabines and the Latins, three of the main enemies of Rome for the last several hundred years, essentially all of their neighbors, form an alliance together, and the Sabines and the Latins together attack Rome. Publius consults the Sibylline books, sacrifices to Pluto, renews festival games to Apollo, and suddenly looks a lot like Numa, right? He brings piety back. We've seen him doing the Romulus things, but we haven't seen him doing a ton of the Numa things, although obviously he built the temple to Jupiter. So then there's a Sabine named Appius Clausus, or Claudius, according to Livy, who is wealthy and illustrious and hated by some of his own people. So he actually tries to make peace with the Romans. And again, Publius has this ability to convert adversaries to allies. He promotes faction within the Sabines and offers Appius Claudius first asylum in Rome. And then when Claudius defects to the Romans and brings 5,000 Sabine families with him, they're all given the rights and privileges of Roman citizens. This is interesting because you're thinking, why are the Romans still fighting the Sabines? Didn't they fight the Sabines in the life of Romulus? Yes, they fight the Sabines for a really long time. They're still fighting the Sabines by the time the social war flares up in the 90s BC. So the Sabines never really seem satisfied. But this lesson from Publius is a good sign as to why they could be satisfied, because as I'm pointing out, 400 years from now, the Italian states are still going to want citizenship and the rights and privileges that come with it. And that's the reason they fight the social war. So Publius is showing exactly what power you have to relieve political tensions by listening to what people want, or maybe even giving them more than what they expect. So Claudius then becomes the head of a very important Roman family, that we'll see passes that Claudius name down, and we get the man who builds an aqueduct, and the Via Appia is a Claudius, and we'll get some famous Claudiuses in the first century, some of whom are not nearly as good as this current Claudius. But all of the families receive 2 acres of land, and Claudius himself becomes a senator and receives 25 acres. So, pretty cool. The Julio-Claudian family, the first emperors of Rome, Julius Caesar, and beyond, are all related to this original Claudius. So the remaining Sabines prosecute their war against Rome. They try to set an ambush, and Publius, aware of this plan, splits his forces into 3 and manages to defeat them in all the places they are at once. He manages to ambush the ambush and defeat the Sabines that are still coming forth and defeat the Sabines that are back in the camp at Fidenae. And because they're all unable to communicate with each other and he had coordinated his plan, it's considered his most brilliant victory to date. He is given credit for the victory, which is not always the case with victorious generals. And obviously great wealth ensues from the capture of so many men and goods. So he celebrates a triumph and promptly dies, handing the power off to the consuls for the following year. He had brought his life to perfection, as Plutarch says. His body was buried at public expense. It was buried within the city limits, with his entire family having the privilege to bury them there, and the women were allowed to mourn for a whole year. So the life ends with a note that the Publii, or the descendants of Publius, are no longer buried inside the city because they can't fit them, so they were all exhumed, and they often will bring the sarcophagus of a member of the Publius family to the spot where they would have been buried, and essentially give them a ritual where they give permission for themselves to be buried outside of the city, and then they're buried there. And thus ends the life of Publius. There's some really cool things that happen in this life. It's a great introduction to the Roman Republic, and it's a little bit shorter than Livy. Livy will really dwell on the details of the story. So Livy is probably more fun to read out loud. Plutarch is a good one to read afterwards as like the outline or Cliff's Notes version. Again, Publius seems to fade into the background sometimes as we focus on these stories of important early Roman citizens. But the main point that Plutarch makes in the parallel between Publius and Solon, and I can talk about this now that we have finished both men, is that Publius seems to live the way Solon said you ought to live. So Solon was a wise man, but Publius was a happy one, is almost the exact way that Plutarch puts it. And I think that's really interesting, curious, cool. The other thing I'll say is that his influence on the Renaissance and early modernity, especially in the founding of the American Republic, can't be understated, as the early Americans were just as afraid as the early Romans of falling back into tyranny. And they knew that they didn't just have to stop fighting when King George III pulled out his last army. They had to continuously be on guard against tyrannical tendencies. Well, that about wraps it for this episode. As always, thanks for the download. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. If you can spare the time, drop a 5-star review in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Share it with your friends on social media. And remember, you can always find the podcast at plutarch.life or grammaticus.co/podcast. But you can even find the podcast by just typing in plutarch.life/the name of whoever you want. So this podcast would be plutarch.life/Publius is how I'm going to put it in here. That's all we have time for today. As always, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast and that I've encouraged you to open Plutarch and let his lives influence yours.